portfolio performance. Ed, welcome.
Good morning. Thank
you. Good morning.
So I think you have the hard copy materials in front of you. We'll just start in behind tab one and take a look at the fourth quarter. Granted, a lot has changed since this. So this is as of 12/31. Paying attention to the markets in February, we saw the return of volatility. We can talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
This recap, though, I think helps put that in context. So why don't we dive in? If we turn to page three, we have our fourth quarter summary, which is always my favorite page in terms of if you have 30 seconds to get our insights on the markets, this is the best page to do that.
Okay.
A couple things I want to highlight on this page in the lower left-hand corner, the bottom dash there is that the markets remain expensive by most measures, and that's true. So while we're seeing strong economic growth that we'll be talking about, there's nothing that looks cheap out there at the same time. So in terms of positioning a portfolio, it remains a strong challenge. On the right-hand side, under investment climate, the second point down there is about S&P 500 earnings, and we see strong growth. So again, this was as of fourth quarter. Now that we're into the first quarter and we've heard the earnings reports of the S&P 500 companies and what actually transpired in fourth quarter, year-over-year growth has been really strong, and it was expected to be strong. So the analysts were expecting 11% year-over-year growth, but that number is coming in more like 15%. And that's with 90% of the companies reporting now. So we have basically all of them in. So I don't expect that number to change significantly. But that's really impressive, and it's also complemented with strong revenue growth so that the companies are really seeing their businesses grow the top line as well. That year-over-year number has been about 8%. So that was higher than expected too. And also the percentage of companies beating estimates is higher. So it's really pretty profound how strong the earnings picture is here in the U.S. Let's skip ahead to page 9, one titled Inflation. The reason why I want to skip to this one is because as we take a look at these charts, the lower three, we're going to see that the numbers are pretty uninspiring, pretty flat, pretty much 2% kind of inflation numbers here. On the lower left-hand side, CPI coming in there, core, excluding food and energy because economists don't have to drive or eat, is about 2%, and headline CPI is also about 2%. No big deal. U.S. tips break even in the middle, also right around 2% for all of these. And then inflation expectations based on a University of Michigan survey and the break-even on the 10-year, also below 3, the University of Michigan survey, higher and consistently higher. So expectations of future inflation have been higher than actual realized. This lays the picture, though, in terms of what happened in February. Because the economic growth continues to come out very positive, and through January we received a number of economic reports that were positive surprises. Into early February, then, as more came out, the discussion around Chair Yellen's view on the economy and transitioning to Chair Powell's view on the economy has all been very optimistic, that they're seeing a lot of good news. And naturally, the bond market takes that as bad news, because that they therefore think that means rates are going to rise. And so while the market had been expecting 3 rate increases in 2018, followed by 3 more in 2019, that view is now starting to shift towards perhaps 4 in 2018. As rates rise on the short end of the curve, then that gives all of the equity analysts pause. And they say, well, if rates are going to rise, then our future cash flows should be discounted more. If those future cash flows are discounted more, today's stock price is too high. I should sell it off and I should get a lower price. And sure enough, that's what happened. And so it kind of happened very quickly. And it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction that we saw. A rise in the 10-year, so the 10-year treasury moves up, the short-term interest rates also are moving up, and then the markets start to sell off, and then we have this technical thing kick in, where the VIX starts to spike, that causes programmatic selling going on, and there's a lot of dispute, discussion about is VIX an appropriate and accurate measure of volatility. It might be something that's being spoofed. It might be something that you can artificially inflate by submitting trades into it and what have you. So these technical things are playing in the background, causing some disturbance. So the market sells off quite a bit in those first couple of weeks. It's now recaptured probably 2/3 of the sell-off. So we had the 10% correction, 10% being a correction. Now it's retraced. And that this is the backstory for it, inflation.
Ed, just before you leave inflation, do you have any sense on what part of the market basket of goods and services that go into the measurement of inflation that rent is? And rent is equivalent, as I'm sure you're aware, if you own a home, there's an equivalent rental number given to you. I just see the kinds of numbers you see as being staggeringly higher.
But again, is that just the Bay Area?
Well, you should have that show up in the Bay Area's separate cost of living.
Right.
The determination as opposed to broad inflation, but it's certainly not limited to the Bay Area. You hear, obviously, stories not as bad as here, but...
Yeah, no, still, Seattle's an example.
Seattle is a good example of that. The fact that it seems to have no impact, and yet you have people with 50, 60, 70% of their disposable income going into their housing. You would think there would be more impact than we're seeing. And that's really sort of my rambling question. Your reaction on that?
It's a good critique. And I'm trying to think now, because I remember looking at this probably 5 or 6 years ago. The CPI metric itself has changed its methodology on this. So rent had been included, and homeowners equivalent had been included, and I forget how that when that transition took place and what they're doing about it today. So they make a proxy attempt at capturing that, but it's on a national level. And so for every area, not for every area, but while we have the areas we're most familiar with as being high rent districts, there are plenty of places in the middle parts of the United States or southern parts of the United States or what have you that aren't seeing rent growth. And so on a blended rate, when you think about a national statistic, it's muted, that effect. So it's in there. Question about methodology being accurate or not and appropriate or not, and then how it gets kind of diluted overall. So we could dig deeper into that. One of the issues too with inflation is how you measure it. When you take a look at CPI, that's one metric. The Fed tends to look at PCE, the personal consumption deflator, more so, I think. And then when you start to dissect that, if you go into the government website, you can really get a lot of detail behind what goes into those numbers. And one of the most interesting ways is to separate out goods from services. And the trajectory of goods is purely deflationary and has been for 20 to 30 years. And so goods just continue to come down, and that's kind of the technology effect, that less labor is involved in producing the goods. It drives down the costs, and so we don't have that. Services has been the exact opposite, strong inflation. So you think about education, healthcare, perhaps housing would be in that side of it. I'm not sure. I need to double check that. Really different pictures. So the inflation is such a blunt instrument. It drives me crazy. So similar to feeling your frustration on rent, wait a minute, are you getting that right? There are a lot of other things in there like, wait, are you getting that right? So it's a blunt instrument, but it is a good way of tying into what the Fed is thinking. And so I think that's what we're trying to accomplish here in terms of getting the Fed picture.
There was a chart making the rounds recently, literally in the last 10 days, showing the divergence in the topics you just described. So you'll see, if you're just looking at a standard graph, the cost of education, healthcare are up on a trajectory like this, and other goods and services are stable or slightly down. And then, you know, the picture's worth a thousand words. You can just look at it, see the labels on what went astronomically high by two or three times versus things that have really been stagnant.
Yeah.
And it's telling the story you just described. I can't remember where I saw it, but it's, I think it was published in the journal as well. I saw a piece from there.
Yeah, I've seen that a couple times. It becomes personal at that point, I think, because then you realize what your exposures are.
Right.
And you start thinking about, I'm going to have those healthcare costs.
Right,
yeah, I'm facing something much more than 2%, so
yes,
I have to do better. I wanted to tie page 9 then into page 10, because this is also a key driver of the inflation story, is the labor side. And with the Fed's dual mandate of keeping inflation at bay of around 2%, while working towards a healthy labor market, this labor market is the other side of the coin for them. And here we also see some really good information on the lower left-hand side. It's the headline unemployment rate, now down to about 4%, 4.1, and the broader measure U6 coming down. And you can see the trajectory of both of those has been really positive since the global financial crisis. So that's great, more people getting back to work, and that's what they're trying to fulfill there. And on the right-hand side, we have the core age participation rate. We've talked about participation in the past, how it's come down from pre-GFC levels of 67, 68, down to post-crisis levels of 62, and there's just this kind of 6% of the labor force not getting back to work. This says, okay, that's fine and dandy, but take a look at the core age, people between 25 and 54, and let's see what their participation rate is. And that's what the lower right-hand side shows. And so you can see it, too, is not back up to pre-financial crisis levels, but it's retraced 50% of that. So it bottomed at 80.6%. It's back up to about 81.9%. 83.3% was the high. So that part of it is painting a strong picture there. Thus, the question becomes the middle chart. And so as we take a look at hourly earnings, as the labor market gets tighter, are we going to see a tick up in hourly earnings? If people start making more, we expect them to spend more, and that would be a cause of inflation there. To date, hasn't happened. So again, this is all just kind of tea leaves in terms of what the market was reading in February, saying, yeah, we expect earnings to tick up, we expect inflation to tick up. You take a look at the long-term charts, it's like, guys, there's nothing to write home about here. I mean, what's the story? You're going to have individual months with blips that are slightly positive, slightly negative, and what have you. Let's not overreact. I think we saw a little bit of overreaction based on some of this, some of the VIX and technicals. But generally, when we look back on this time in history, we're going to say, yeah, interest rates moved up, caused a repricing of equities. They sold off a little bit. Everything kind of reached equilibrium, and things are back to normal by and large. So a bit of a roller coaster of a month.
What groups fit into the average hourly earnings? And do CEOs fit into that? Is it labor force?
Largely labor force. Okay. I doubt CEOs are fitting in there in any meaningful way. Their numbers would be so small.
Okay. So, but they're not part of the group. It's more going to be the, I guess you...
Yeah, I'd have to dig into that because they're looking at payroll kind of numbers, and CEOs are often compensated a small portion on payroll, a large portion on bonus.
Right.
So I would expect that that isn't being captured, or they're making some adjustment. I don't know what that is, though, Gabe. That's a good question. I can follow up on that. Let's jump ahead to page 14, take a look at the global economies briefly. But just on the right-hand side, you've seen this chart before, and so the only point I'll really make about it is that all of these numbers continue to improve. So we have the United States at the top as reference, and then you can see Western Europe now showing even stronger GDP growth, 2.5. Our GDP for fourth quarter came out. The revised number this morning was 2.5, so we're right in line with that. Japan, with positive economic growth, which is almost surprising given the demographic headwinds they have there of a aging population that continues to retire, but their stimulus really seems to be working. And then the BRICS countries in aggregate and then broken out in detail. So it's really a global story. We continue to beat the drum on it being a global story, as do many others in the markets. Page 17 is another way of looking at that.
Unfortunately, India a few years ago supposed to be the growth. What's going on with India now?
So
I mean, they're at 5.3. I'm just curious. I used to hear a lot about investing in India, and there's a lot going on. But lately, it's been quiet. So is there anything?
Oh, I think that's just a function of the headlines and what they're paying attention to. The story continues. Right. So with China and India, you have a strong trend of urbanization. So you have people who are the developing middle class, and as a country develops a middle class, there tends to be a huge increase in consumption of homes, televisions, durable goods, technology, all those kinds of things. And so as they move into a middle class that can afford that, the billion people that they have and the buying power that represents is pretty profound. So that's a long-term trend I think we can watch over the next 20 years.
Okay. Yeah.
Page 17, I just mentioned that because this continues the trend of the Purchasing Managers Index, all showing very favorable responses. Anything above 50 is growth, and you're seeing it around the world by manufacturing, by services. So it's a coordinated global growth story. I'd like to skip ahead to 31, equity valuations. this gets back to the point that nothing looks cheap around the world. Some things look cheaper than others. And this is pretty informative relative to our portfolio, because as we take a look on 31 at the lower left-hand side, we have the forward-looking price-to-earnings ratios charted out. And you can see by this metric that the United States looks most expensive. The green line, the MSCI EFA index, international developed markets, now looks moderately cheaper, and emerging markets looks cheaper. And that's pretty interesting, because emerging markets has had quite a nice run, north of 30% in the past year, in 2017. International markets, international developed, did about the same as the U.S., so kind of 20%, slightly better than the U.S. So even with those years, they're still relatively cheap. And so we still have a significant portion of our assets allocated in that way. We like this as a fundamental driver of valuation. This doesn't mean that we can't withstand a drawback or a pullback in it, but it's a good thing to look to. Long-term valuations matter. And then the next two charts, trailing PE ratios, another view of it, and the right-hand side, a couple other valuation metrics, price to book, price to cash flow, dividend yield, and earnings yield, all paint a similar story. U.S. generally being most expensive, developed, international, second, and EM cheapest. Those. Then I'll just wrap up with a quick recap on page 42, taking a look at the major benchmark indices. So a strong quarter, again, for the U.S. equity markets, generally 6% kind of returns, except for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, posting at 11%. And a strong one-year number, most of these north of 20 or high teens. Down below, international markets, similarly, strong quarter again, 5-7% returns. Also a strong year, upper 20s, low 30s. EFA small cap, so small cap stocks internationally did quite well. Emerging markets, 37%. Upper right-hand corner, fixed income, doing what we expected to do, positive returns. Not much downside there. And then lower right-hand corner, various other commodities, REITs, leveraged loans, emerging market debt, hedge fund, and currency benchmarks. Comparison.
Emerging markets, Asia, 42.8. Lower left, that's pretty incredible.
That's pretty incredible. So, yeah.
I mean, that's a year. I mean, that's a one-year number, right? That's a roll-up. But that's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. Pretty terrific. And does a lot to bring its 5 and 10 year more in line. So, that 10-year only at 3.6 is kind of the funny thing there. So as you take a look at the 10-year and stack it up against the others, it's roughly in line. So
yeah. It
gives you a sense of the volatility to all this stuff, too. If it has that kind of year, it really recovered a lot that it had lost in the past. So,
investors, or is it going to adjust going forward, though?
Sure. it should get a little more stability as those countries evolve and come to appreciate foreign capital and what it can mean to them. So those are all my prepared comments on the markets. We can move on to the plan if you'd like.
Actually, you just said something that made me want to ask a question. What, and if you've said it before, I apologize, I don't remember the answer, but what's the sort of the defined line for when a market is no longer an emerging market and it becomes something more mature or different? And is there some understood convention of what that is?
There is roughly. It's based on GDP per capita. And currently, I think there are 24 countries, 23 or 24, in what is generally defined as emerging market universe. But no one shares a single definition. So there's not one that everyone uses.
Okay.
You'll see some differences manager to manager, and you'll see some differences benchmark to benchmark. And then, IMF or global policy kind of think tanks or what have you have their own definitions too. So things that are sometimes on that cusp, like South Korea, by most metrics would be considered developed, but in a lot of portfolios is still considered emerging.
When you look at Seoul, you think it's kind of developed, but
yeah,
right.
It's a pretty big, bustling, thriving city.
Yeah.
Country's ever gone from out of emerging markets and then back into it again? Has that ever happened?
It's usually a pretty slow process to make the transition. So I don't know that I've ever seen one do that. Usually if you're kind of on that cusp line, you're going to be considered EM until you clearly break through. And again, there's no single definition. So like that South Korea story, some developed managers invest in South Korea saying it's a developed country. Of course, we're going to invest there. And plenty of emerging market managers invest there saying it's still an emerging market country. So I think that'd be a good example of one on the line.
The closest we've seen is Greece, almost crossing that line again, but right.
Ed, is there a bright line when we talk about frontier markets?
We're actually producing a research piece on that.
I was not aware of that. That wasn't a segue for them. But I mean, it's a very interesting area, and a lot of these, reports they get lumped into emerging markets, but it's definitely a different area, and they have unique operational challenges. Right. But if you're able to mine those good opportunities, I think it's a very interesting part, but.
It is.
Not one that we're heavily allocated in for a number of reasons.
Yeah. But we do have some exposure, but pretty minor, pretty much at the margin that it's in there. But I at this point, I'd be more tempted to say, let me come back to you next month with what our research has on that. Because they're looking at it thinking exact same thing. If it's an inefficient market, that should give managers who are willing to roll up their sleeves and do the research an advantage. And so let's figure out if they can actually pin that down and capture some of that value. The question always is, at what risk? And typically it's more of the operational risk. Custodians have trouble setting up accounts there to actually buy and sell the markets and what have you. So you get into other kinds of issues with it.
Is frontier a category like emerging markets? I'm not familiar with it.
I think it's a colloquial kind of thing, just referring to when you talk about those 24 emerging markets and you talk about the developed markets, that's actually a small number relative to the number of countries around the world. So when you invest in those other countries, what are they, and can you invest in them? So, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So there are, basically there are funds out there you could invest in that specialize in frontier.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. I've heard the term used at different conferences, the frontier market. What's an example? I mean, would like Thailand or one of those, or
a lot of the African countries,
African ones. Okay.
Yeah, and that there's something to be said about that, right? I mean, demographic trends, if they're able to remove some of the political instability and create some economic stability that encourages foreign capital to come in, that creates a better lifestyle, better living standards, and the development someday of a middle class kind of thing. So. See.
And Libya could be a really good market.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So let's move on then to a review of the portfolio. If we turn to tab 2. Taking a look at page 2 with the cash flows, starting out the quarter, 8.3 billion. Net investment change more than offsetting outflows, so ending market value of 8.53 billion. Jumping ahead to page 4, our asset allocation is in line with targets. As we work towards the long term, we have the current targets down below, as outlined in phase 2 of the implementation plan there, and all of those check out. So we're in good shape from that perspective. If we turn to page 5, take a look at our performance gross of fees, compare against our peers, and you can see that nice numbers on an absolute basis, not so great on a relative basis. So here, for the quarter, performing in line with policy index, 3.3 versus 3.3, 82nd percentile. To give you some perspective on that, the median ranking for the peer group is a 3.8% return. So we're behind it by 0.5. For the fiscal year to date, in 1 year, same time period there, 14.2. versus 13.8. The median performance there for the peer group was 16.2, so we lagged by about 2% for the year. Not surprising, as we take a look at our peers, those that performed on the higher end of the median had higher allocations to equities than we do. Typical, it was a risk-taking kind of year. The more risk you took on, the better results you got. in terms of alignment with what we've been talking about trying to do with our asset allocation and policy and the FFP framework and fitting to the liabilities of the plan, certainly in line with that. We see that across all of these time frames, or at least out to 10 years, we have beaten the actuarial assumed rate and individual portfolio sections behaving as we would expect them to. So then looking down within the growth section, we have underperformance for the quarter of the growth composite, 4.5 versus 6.2 for, 4.5 in aggregate. Okay, that's fine. 6.2, modest underperformance versus domestic equities of 6.3, international outperforming in total, with the bulk of the outperformance coming from our emerging markets managers versus slight underperformance from the developed managers. And page 6, taking a look at global equities, underperformance here, 4.3 versus 5.7. Domestic fixed income, we're showing outperformance of 2.5 in total, high yield underperforming there, and then real estate, nice outperformance on real estate. Alternatives, an opportunistic pull in the closed-end funds for the private equity and the other opportunistic funds there. Risk diversifying portfolio, 1.7% in aggregate with fixed income and inflation hedge. Inflation hedge outperforming nicely. And then the liquidity portfolio on page 7. So I think this is interesting. Now we have the one-year number for our liquidity portfolio coming in at 1.5. We had talked about this being a 2% kind of yielding portfolio, and that's true. So the yield is right around 2%, as we can see from the managers, or thereabouts. This calculation also includes the price change of those bonds, and so as rates move up, prices go down. So we have some detraction on the capital appreciation side. Then cash.
Ed, could you talk for a moment about alternatives and the benchmark that we utilize? Because some trustees may have a difference there.
Specific to the benchmark itself?
Yeah.
S&P 500?
About the total alternatives?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, when we think about the alternatives, I'm largely thinking about private equity as being the bulk of that. Private equity is seeking to outperform publicly traded equity. The general construct is saying there's an illiquidity premium for investing there. That's kind of a handy shorthand way of thinking about things, but that's probably more to it than just illiquidity, because what we're doing with private equity is we're investing with funds that actually take an active role in the companies that they invest in. And so we look at all of these things and say, you should be getting, you're taking more risk and you should be compensated for it. And therefore, if we take the public market proxy of the S&P 500 and say we expect more than that, we've tagged it with a 4% weight. So thank you very much for the equity exposure. Now get us 4% on top of public equities. So that's the mindset of it. And there's a lot more research behind it than what I just gave you, but kind of shorthand, that's it. Alternatives, we're seeing underperformance there. So I think this is a really difficult number to comment on quarter to quarter, because when you take the positions in the portfolios and it's a private fund, we're dealing with a lot of the valuations of those companies that are done not by the broad market like we have in the public markets, but by the valuation methodologies applied. And the realizations are really what's key. So whenever they actually distribute capital back to us, what is that based on? And so the detail reports that we have later in here help show that manager by manager. And thus, when you take a look at the performance of alternatives going out longer time frame, it looks better relative to the benchmark. You can see some consistent double-digit numbers, which is nice to see. The S&P 500, with the rally that it's had over the past couple of years, has really been staggering. And so that bogey of S&P 500 plus 4 is a really hard benchmark to beat at this time. Does that answer your question? Okay. If we skip ahead to page 10, take a quick look at the total plan on a risk-adjusted basis. Uh, I always say this is my favorite page. It remains my favorite page. So we have annualized returns over the past 5 years, gross of fees of 9.7, annualized standard deviation of 4.5. And when we talk to you, and we'll be talking to you again soon about the asset allocation work that we do with you, we really have this portfolio kind of dialed in more to a 7% kind of expected return. So getting 9, almost 10, is definitely a bonus on top of that. And we would expect a volatility more of 11 to 12. And here we have 4.5. So the markets have been very kind to us, low volatility and higher returns. Also on the right-hand side, the right two columns show the upmarket and downmarket capture. So important ratios here. Upmarket having 100%, so when the market's moving up, how much of that do we capture? We capture all of it. Downmarket capture, when the markets are moving down, how much do we capture of that? 80% of it. So we play good defense. That's really nice to see. So we think that's particularly important with a pension plan where when the markets are down, you still got to make your payments. And you want to have that capital in your accounts so that when the recovery happens, you enjoy the recovery. So having those two numbers be that strong is really impressive. And we seek to continue that with the asset allocation structure that we have in place. Turning to page 11, a couple comments on individual managers. You can see some pretty significant underperformance with Jackson Square, particularly due to Celgene, Symantec, and Allergan. Modest recovery in January. The January numbers beat their benchmark, not enough to recapture this delta. So that's pretty significant underperformance. And it's unfortunate because 2016 was a year of underperformance. 2017, under versus benchmark, above median versus peers. So that's a challenging strategy there for us.
Hey, Ed, I'm sorry. I need to. I had a question and I just couldn't.
Yeah.
It. What's the numerator and the denominator in the upmarket capture ratio? Because I'm trying to understand the concept of capturing 100.46% of the upside, but knowing, I think, that we, by design, because of the way we've broken up the portfolio, aren't going to have, you know, like 100% all in equity day at the races, right? So when we say we captured 100.46% of the upside, give me the numerator and denominator so I better understand that.
Yeah, so the numerator is going to be our fund performance during those periods when the market is moving up, and the denominator is going to be the market during the times that the market is going up. So you look at the past history and segment the times when the market's going up versus down, and you pick out those times and separate them into up market and down markets. So we have those data sets separated then over the past 5 years. Then we take each one of those and say, okay, what was the plan's performance during the up market times, and what was the market's performance during the up market times, and similarly with down market. And then we say that we historically have captured 100% of that upside.
What markets are you talking about? And we break them all down.
Okay. Yeah.
So what do you do when some are going up and some are going down? How do you consider that an up or down market?
Yes.
Or is it just based on that particular category that blended together?
Blended together. So it's taking policy. Take your total policy and do it that way. So I think the key question is, how do we work going forward versus how have we worked historically? So take a look at our five-year number. A lot of that, the bulk of that, is not the FFP construct. Going forward,
right,
employing the FFP construct, we expect that, as Tim's education session pointed out last month, that risk-return profile, the kind of the bell-shaped curve, if you remember that schematic, shows that we would expect to give up some of the upside in protection of the downside. So going forward, would you expect to see 180 as your numbers? No. And by the way, those numbers change every time I come to you, but that's the current number. So it might look more like 90% upside, 80% downside, or something in that ballpark where you want more on upside than you do on downside. So that directionally is what we're trying to accomplish.
So my reaction to this is probably being influenced that I'm looking at 5-year condensed history, that is the prior portfolio and asset allocation, whereas I'm thinking about FFP and how it can and should perform in these markets. So I'm probably melding the two. I was just reacting to the 100.46%, but that's an amalgam of, would you say, five years of data, so it doesn't really reflect the asset allocation. I would expect that the defensive posture would be good. I think I shared with you on the break, and I sent a note to Tim when, after January 26, when all hell broke loose, right, and you saw all that volatility and craziness, you know, that my reaction was, this is when having an FFP construction on a long-term basis insulates you from a lot of the downside risk that would otherwise attend if you were just all in equities, right? If you were just all in, you were just all over the board, and potentially for a 2018, you could find yourself down. Right? Mm-hmm. Whereas with a fully fleshed out FFP, we'd have a defensive posture for that downside. And it sounds like we already had one pretty well built in anyway.
Yeah.
Because of the 80% number. In other words, our existing structure was insulating us somewhat from the downside effect.
Well, and the past 5 years have largely been up market.
Right.
So, yeah, we haven't had a good test on that downside, I guess, would be something we should keep in mind, too. Yeah.
That's true.
Not that we're advocating for
it. No. You want to try one out?
2015 wasn't exactly a walk in the park.
Right.
If I remember correctly, but
that spread is what we're trying to maintain there. That spread might move over time, but if anything, we're trying to widen that spread so it could capture even less of the downside going forward.
Okay. Well, thank you. I didn't mean to. I know you had jumped to the next topic, but it was just, I just needed to get it out. Thank you.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it was good.
I recently heard a statistic that humans daydream 2,000 times a day. I was amazed by that. It was like 2,000. I feel like I'm behind. I should.
That's an average.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Just hit 1,500 for the morning.
Yes. So you're an adult. Take your time today.
Let's see. Other highlights, taking a look at the individual strategies. We had some really nice performance in the small cap, both with Emerald and Ceradex. And so LendingTree was a big help for Emerald, and Ceradex had exposure to American Eagle and Regal Theaters, so hopefully you're going to see the movies. Black Panther. Mm-hmm. Haven't seen it yet, but Jumanji, I have seen that. I highly recommend it.
I heard it was good.
Where's the movie review page?
Page 12.
Yeah, right. It gives it 5 stars.
Recommendations to the underlying assets. Right.
Yeah. Page 12, a couple quick remarks, a little bit of underperformance here from Pierford and William Blair. We discussed the personnel changes with you at William Blair, with Stephanie Bramming moving on to the CEO role and backfilling her with Ken. And just in talking with Tim before the meeting, you had mentioned you had a conversation with Ken, and it is comforting. So. Liking what we're seeing there of the team, certainly want to continue to pay attention to it. It could well be an upgrade in many respects. So,
Tim, what's the last conversation you had with Jackson Square?
Jackson Square, we touched base with them right about the end of January.
So you're still getting return calls. That's good. A little concerned.
We're getting our phone calls answered, not even the return calls. They're actually answering them in the first ring. So.
Okay. It's a sensitive area.
It is probably the second most closely monitored portfolio in the lineup right now.
Whoa, what's number one?
It's a horse race, but that one kind of changes, but Jackson Square is persistently.
Yeah, that's the thing that keeps coming up for me is it's the persistency of, they could be faulted for, gee, we guessed wrong on this, we guessed wrong on that, but it seems to me they've got a lot of wrong guesses.
I think the disconcerting part of the Jackson Square narrative has been there are individual stock stories that are really knocking the performance down in a material way.
Yeah.
It happened during the GFC with their exposure to MGM Grand. There was a big trouble spot. They recovered from that. 2016, we saw a big trouble spot up with some pharmaceutical company that we have ongoing dialogue about. And last year, while having a decent full year, had a very difficult fourth quarter.
Yeah.
And again, stock specific, it's a concentrated portfolio, it's a 30 stock portfolio. But risk control is the number one conversation we have with them.
I mean, every one of the firms always comes in, and if they come in to make a performance, they all have a similar strategy. Talk about how much of a structure they go through and stock selection and whatnot. And I would hope that they're revisiting whatever filter that they're using, because it doesn't seem to be doing the trick.
They are revisiting it. We are also revisiting their role in our life.
Okay. That's enough. Thanks.
If you take a look, you don't have to turn to it, but page 32, some of these back pages in the report that we don't really address within the discussion we have each quarter can be helpful in understanding some of these, and I think this is a good example.
Yeah.
So on the bottom right-hand side, you can see the bottom contributors. To Tim's point, this is a concentrated portfolio. Here we're showing 33 holdings as of the end of the quarter. So something like Celgene having a negative 28% return and being a 4% weight in the portfolio
right. Is
part of what whipsaws that result.
Yeah. Which is an extension of the story.
Yeah.
The Jackson Square story. Okay.
Exactly.
Right. Yes. I would call that unfortunate. Mm-hmm. I see that number.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mantech, Allergan, TripAdvisor, and EA, and Nielsen. So. Let's see, flipping back to 12, getting TT in the portfolio now, we're seeing another quarter from them, really strong, 10.1%. Good to see their emerging markets exposure. This is another one where turning to the back pages is helpful because they invest in companies I can't pronounce, so where they invest. Artisan Partners had a bit of a challenging quarter, but you can see their longer-term track record is quite strong,
yeah. Both
relative against benchmark and peers. First Eagle has a challenging position here. You can see their individual years. 2013 wasn't great. They lagged an index that was rallying pretty strongly, but they played nice defense in 2014, 15, 16. Actually outperformed in 16, 17 underperformed again. And keep in mind, this is a strategy that has a pretty significant exposure to cash of close to 20%, so they play defense that way. They have a gold position of about 7%, they play defense that way. So when the markets are rallying, like we saw in 2017, those positions aren't going to do well. When the markets do correct, then they have dry powder to invest, and they are naturally preserving capital in that way. So this is a good example where they're sticking to their knitting in terms of what we expect them to do, but in this kind of market environment, they're not going to do well. Yeah. So we have to expect that, I think.
Isn't the First Eagle that actually holds the commodity as well?
We hold gold bullion. Yes.
Right. Yeah, okay. I noticed the commercials have finally dropped off a bit about why the past 5 years, this is a perfect time to be in gold.
Gold, right.
I think the commercials have now begun to bottom out. They'll be right someday, but...
Page 13, we have Allianz Global, or high yield exposure, performs 0.2 versus 0.4, 90th percentile. They had some exposure to support services, energy, and telecom that caused their relative underperformance. And they're generally more defensive in nature, going towards the higher quality end of high yield, whereas the lower quality has really been the place to be as these balance sheets have been clean and they've been able to get capital and do well. So they're more conservative positioning against, again, a kind of defensive play in that respect. No other particular comments throughout the rest. AFL-CIO, 81st percentile, but 0.3 versus 0.4, so actually pretty close in line with their benchmark. And Wellington underperforms as well. For the year, 1.9 versus 6.2 isn't encouraging. They have about a 28% position in cash, and they're competing against CPI plus 4, so looking for the inflation protection there, the cash exposure wasn't helpful, and their equities selection within the equities portion of the portfolio was also somewhat detrimental to their performance. And then page 14 has the short-term DFA, Insight, and SIT results.
And what's your thoughts on those?
You know, this is more about fulfilling the functional portfolio, and I think they're doing that quite well. So I think Insight is fulfilling its mission of generating the benefit payments. CIT's uniqueness and niche portion of the market is allowing them to outperform. So you see their one-year number 1.3 versus 0.4. So they're doing smart selection there. And again, most of this is really about the coupon and getting a kind of 2% coupon. We have some detail in the back on those. You have to go all the way back, though, to 16.9, I think it is. Yeah. So beginning on page 69, you can see the coupon off of TFA is...
Before you leave that, Tim or Ed, on page 13 on Allianz, they seem to be just consistently lagging the benchmark year after year. And I just wonder if there's something uniquely different about their approach. I have to be reminded of how their approach fills this niche and how it can underperform as often as it does.
So Allianz is more of a high-quality high-yield manager, which is a little bit of an oxymoron. But within that lower-quality spectrum of credit, they tend to play in what's called the double B and single B space, which is double B would be just below investment grade, single B below that, and the high-yield index would extend down to triple C. Historically speaking, and by design, they tend to avoid the triple C space, thinking that that is subject to higher default rates, higher loss rates, and essentially stay up in quality. Now, the reality has been that the triple C space, despite having a higher risk profile, has actually had some pretty strong returns over time. And a lot of that's been driven in the past couple of years by energy companies dropping down in quality through the triple C space, rallying back through the triple C space. And there's a lot of velocity in the triple C space that they're simply not exposed to. So I think there's a good story here about staying up in quality. Generally, it protects you from defaults. So the reality has been we've missed out on returns of companies, as Ed said, improving their balance sheets, having the pricing come back on the high-yield securities, and that's really not part of the Allianz opportunity set here. Now, one of the things that's going to come up at the next meeting is we do not have a strategic weight to high yield in the portfolio. This is considered transitory in nature at this point in time while we're really building out the private markets exposure. I think there are pricing considerations in the high yield market. There's been a lot of issuance in the high yield market that's going to affect some of the dynamics going forward here, and there's another conversation to be had about how long high yield remains part of our portfolio, both from Allianz specific considerations, but more broadly from an asset class consideration.
Because at least on page 12, that's gross of fees. So net of fees, the performance there is going to even be worse, for lack of a better word.
Now, I mean, they have had some downside protection. I believe in 2015, there was a percentage of downside protection, although that's pretty short comfort when you look at long-term records. In 2013, there's outperformance. 2014 lagged a bit. 2015, protection in a falling market. That was really the energy story kind of starting to come in there in 2015. But as the market rallied, the triple C segment of the market really rallied, they're significantly underweight that relative to their peers and relative to the index.
Yeah. And I guess that raises the issue, and then again, a question about the extent to which we're willing to take greater risk. And if we are too narrowly focused on the lower risk component, if you will.
It absolutely brings up the question of what does it do for us?
Right.
And if we're looking for it to be that broad exposure to something that doesn't exist elsewhere in our portfolio, and we're giving them a narrow mandate, there's a little bit of a mismatch there. So
right.
That's in context of the asset allocation review coming up, I would anticipate Allianz being a topic of conversation, maybe not next month, but later this year.
Okay, thanks. Sorry, Ed.
No.
Got you off your track there.
we were just wrapping up with the liquidity mandates. And, the back in 69, 70, and 71 have pages on each of these that show coupon, quality, maturity, and effective duration. So that coupon, you can see DFA generating a 2.7, almost 2.8% coupon. Insight at 2.4 and SIT at 6.4. So the stability of those coupons is part of the desirable characteristic we have there for the FFP construct. Skipping ahead to page 18, we have, by the way, those middle pages do have the net of fees performance, so Jerry, to your point.
Yep.
Page 18 and 19 showing the progression of the closed-end funds, and 20 in terms of the capital called and distributed back, and then 21 and 22 showing the high RRs. So we'll continue to show this. I know Stepstone will be integrating into the process, providing supplemental reporting on the private equity and private credit strategies. We'll continue to provide this to you, so that will be additive. And then we'll also be continuing to do the real estate closed-end funds in this way, too. And then page 25 has your fee summary for each of the publicly traded funds. Wrapping on to page 26. So that concludes my prepared comments.
Okay. Anything else for Ed? Seeing none. Thank you.
That was good.
Thank you.